Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the MHPN webinar on Multidisciplinary Masterclass. I'd like to start tonight by acknowledging the traditional owners on which we're all joining this evening. I'm joining from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and I'd like to pay my deepest respects to their elders past and present, and note that these lands were never ceded. I would also like to acknowledge the contribution of those with lived and living experience to the work that we do. I know that all of us on the panel have learnt so much and are guided by those that share their stories, and I'd like to acknowledge any of those that are in the room with us this evening. So we've got a really packed full schedule tonight. We're really excited to have so many people joining us to talk about best practice multidisciplinary care in eating disorders. I'm Sarah Trobe, and I'm the National Director of the National Eating Disorders Collaboration, and I'm also a clinical psychologist. I am joined by a wonderful panel from our sector, and we've just had a wonderful few days together at our Australia and New Zealand Eating Disorders Conference. So it's really nice to be joining back together, and also during Body Image and Eating Disorders Awareness Week here in Australia. So thank you everyone for taking the opportunity to engage in this learning experience with us tonight. And I really encourage you to engage in and connect with other resources and activities that are happening during the week. So tonight I will be facilitating a case discussion, a hypothetical case discussion through three different stories. And I'm joined by Amy Woods, a lived experience advisor and also counsellor, Karen Spielman, our GP, Philippa Hay, a psychiatrist, and Tom Scully, our dietitian. We'll be presenting and introducing a brief hypothetical case study. And then we're going to be really on our toes and just thinking on the spot about how multidisciplinary care could work for this person. I might throw in some curveballs. We'll just see where the conversation goes. But I'll be really leaning on our panel here to be thinking about how we can provide best case multidisciplinary care for these people, but also thinking about the complexities and challenges that MDT care can bring and the challenges we might face in bringing a team together around different diagnostic presentations, really supporting a person with an eating disorder and other co-occurring conditions also. I know that those in the audience will be joining us from, you know, and from a perspective of different professions. And what I will say is when I talk about mental health professionals, I'm really talking about the broad number of professions that sit under that umbrella. So our psychologists, social workers, occupational therapists, counsellors, mental health nurses. So many different people can provide the mental health or psychological treatment, but rather than naming lots of different professions, I'll probably just use that term as we go through. I guess what we'll also be thinking is thinking about risk and how we might be managing risk between our care team, how we're having conversations and communicating with each other as well, and really thinking about what does person-centered care mean, and we'll be exploring some challenges to that if the care team are not aligned in our perspectives on the case. So I'm going to introduce the first case, and we're not going to start easy. We're going to start with a fairly complex case, but also something that's quite timely with some introduction of different medications that are coming onto the scene at the moment. So if the panel are with me, I'd like to introduce our first case, which is Arthur. Arthur is a 44-year-old male. He has been referred by his GP to a dietitian. So I'm going to be throwing to Tom first. He's been referred to Tom for weight management. So the GP has determined that Arthur is classified as overweight. And so Arthur has come to you, Tom, to talk about weight management. Arthur hasn't started any medications, but he has expressed interest in talking about and exploring the option of GLP weight loss management, which are some of those drugs like Ozempic, which have come on the scene recently. Tom, when you first see Arthur, you complete your assessment and you identify that Arthur may have binge eating disorder. So I'm going to ask you the first question, Tom, is why would this case be complex? Like, where do you start with a presentation like the one that Arthur is bringing?
Yeah, thanks, Sarah. I think it's definitely a common presentation that I am increasingly coming across. We know that rates of eating disorders are higher in people with weight and shape concern, particularly people engaging with weight management services, whether that's seeking bariatric surgery or weight loss medication. And yeah, it's tricky because on the one hand, often people's desire for weight loss makes a lot of sense. I want to feel more comfortable within myself, or maybe I want to manage some health concerns. We know that weight loss attempts and behaviors that people engage in to lose weight can actually exacerbate eating disorder behaviors, particularly things like binge eating, where we might see that restrict binge cycle come in. And so we want to, I guess, validate Arthur's desire to lose weight and just get a bit curious about what ways, if any, this might be feeding into some of the other things that are going on for him, like the binge eating. So I guess I'd start with just being curious about, well, what's the desire for weight loss for? Is this something that you've been pushing for yourself, or are you feeling pressure from other people, perhaps to lose some weight? Is this, are there health concerns in here that maybe are increasing pressure to want to lose weight? Something like some insulin resistance or type 2 diabetes wouldn't be uncommon with this type of presentation. Or is this just about appearance and body image and how you feel within yourself? I'd
Cool.
probably want to know a little bit of what he's done as well in terms of trying to lose weight in the past. Is this a first attempt, or is there a bit of a history here that we could dig into?
Yeah, nice. So you obviously a more comprehensive assessment, getting a full picture of Arthur's history, his current presentation. And I was hearing in there too that there might have been some extra health information that you might want to obtain. How would you go about it if Arthur wasn't able to provide a full health history? What would be your approach with the GP in that instance?
Yeah, lovely. So I think Arthur's been referred, hopefully he's been referred with maybe a chronic disease management plan or something that has a bit of that information in there. But if that hasn't been provided, then absolutely we make sure I've got consent to reach out and perhaps get some of that information from whoever's involved in his care team at the moment. We know that sometimes people, particularly who've got a bit of health stuff going on, might get a little bit overwhelmed or struggle to kind of remember all of the details. So yeah, chasing it up from where the records are kept.
Yeah, nice. Karen, I'm going to throw to you. In this particular instance, if Arthur had first presented to you as an eating disorder informed GP, you're aware of the risks that can come with GLPs and towards eating disorders. But Arthur came to you expressing interest in wanting to explore weight management. How would you approach that with him?
Thanks, Sarah. If Arthur's come to me first, then I would to actually take a pretty similar approach to Tom, taking my time to understand where he's coming from. We've learned a lot in the last few years about people's seeking weight management, and there are a lot of people in general practice who are interested in the area. So there has been a lot of information coming to us loud and clear in general practice land. Probably overwhelms the eating disorder information a little bit. So I think one of my first approaches would be to take that into account and just make sure that I'm coming from a weight neutral perspective to start with, being curious about exactly, as Tom said, what are his reasons, and asking the question about relationship with food and with his body, just to ascertain at a fairly early stage. And that's what I'm hoping to be able to educate my GP colleagues on, that if we can start bringing this into the conversation earlier, it does help us to work out those risks that you're talking about, Sarah, because we know that if we miss an eating disorder in a person seeking weight management, that can be really dangerous. Exacerbate the eating disorder. And on the other hand, we know that there are some risks of being overweight, understanding different people's language use, which I know the NEDC has been really great at, and helping educate people, but that not necessarily the health risks may not necessarily be related to weight. So it becomes a very nuanced conversation. And I would definitely be taking my time to try and work out where Arthur wants to start. As you said, a patient-centered approach.
Yeah, beautiful. And so, if you then you did, it was just wonderful to have a GP, Karen, that could hopefully have that time in the system that we have with possibly short session time with a GP and you've identified that Arthur does have binge eating disorder, what would that mean for where you refer Arthur and what that care team might look like?
Well, binge eating disorder, as with all eating disorders, requires such a beautiful communication between a multidisciplinary team. And, the older and wiser I get, the more I realize we cannot do these things on our own. People and their health issues are very complex, and the more skilled and informed people that we communicate with, the better it is, the better outcomes it is for our patients. So, I would definitely be including a dietitian and a psychologist, and if there were any complications that we weren't able to manage at that primary health stage, then including specialist input from somebody like Philippa and her colleagues would be terrific as well, because there can be complex comorbidities, can't there, with binge eating. We're very, more and more aware of a whole heap of common comorbidities.
Beautiful. That was a perfect segue, Karen. I was actually going to go to you next, Philippa, just to think about the care team and, recognizing that understanding weight loss medications, it's a new thing that not the whole care team might even understand what they are, how they might interact, what the risks are. Philippa, how would you approach that with a care team if you felt that maybe the team weren't aligned in the treatment approach or understanding why we're trying to do what we're doing?
Well, I'm really lucky. I work with a wonderful multidisciplinary team, and they're really receptive to conversations about should we be using Ozempic for this person or not, etc. And I think it's really important to think the fact that this is a comorbidity. This person has two problems. Potentially, he certainly has a mental health problem, which is the binge eating disorder. And I'd definitely be sort of referring back to Karen and saying, please fill out, the eating disorder care plan, because binge eating disorder is a significant mental health disorder with significant morbidity, comorbidities, depression, mood changes, and also putting my sort of mental health professional hat on, not assuming this is binge eating disorder. Many people also have non-purging forms of bulimia nervosa. So this person might be just going from binge to fast cycle, and have very dysregulated eating and associated mental health impairments as a result of bulimia nervosa. And the thing I'd be stressing to Arthur is that it is a disorder and it's a very treatable disorder. And no matter what happens with weight or Ozempic, etc., we can, help you with the eating disorder, because there are actually very effective psychological therapies for binge eating disorder that work. And so let's get on and help you with that, not ignoring the fact there may be also significant medical comorbidities, but we have to think about what they are, what they may be, and working with a physician or with Karen, with the GP, in terms of managing those. And really, there's now, I think, a view that there is this now the Lancet Commission view of what's called clinical obesity, that there is high weight and then there is impacts of high weight on the person's metabolic status, on their physical health and their cardiovascular status, etc. And that's a very different situation to where that isn't there. There may be increased risk because of high weight, but they're actually at the moment aren't a lot of medical comorbidities. So when one says someone is overweight or high weight, that's a huge spectrum of, of presentation. And it may be that Arthur doesn't have anything that really needs to be addressed, but he does have a significant mental health disorder and we can address it. So that's where I would start.
Yeah, wonderful. There was so much in there. You'll all see me when I put my head down. I'm just jotting down notes because that was, and I'm going to come full circle back to you, Philippa. But Amy, if it's okay, I wanted to throw to you in that a few of those ideas that were coming out there is around the idea of person-centered care, that we might have identified binge eating disorder, and Arthur is saying, I really want to lose weight. Do you have any reflections on, person-centered care in this instance and how the care team can just provide the wraparound support for him?
Yeah, the thing that really strikes me here is making sure that we're understanding
what Arthur's relationship is to kind of the world around him in the body that he's in. If he's presenting in a larger body, then we also need to understand what's his relationship to diet culture and weight stigma. What are the experiences, negative or positive, that he may have experienced around being in the body that he's in, and how is that particularly, impacting things like depression and anxiety and self-esteem and all of that. So, what I think Karen and Tom and Philippa all really spoke to was kind of creating these spaces where he can have his body story sort of heard. So we're not just jumping to a conclusion of, yep, okay, great, we're going to put you on the GLP-1, or no, nope, that's not happening, we're going to send you off for a therapy that you don't want, but actually creating space to kind of hear him in all of his complexity or all of his nuances, so that we see him as a whole, and that also he has space to unravel a little bit of that himself as well. Just this idea of kind of having a pause, a collective pause together, and saying, all right, let's unravel this a little bit further before we make any decisions. Because ultimately, this is his life and this is his body. And I think, with eating disorder professionals, we're always like, no, go the treatment, go the treatment. But it's a really, really tricky world that we live in, and it's even going to be even more complex for somebody that is living in a larger body.
Thank you, Amy. It just got me reflecting. I was fortunate to attend a session on complexity at the conference on the weekend, and the importance of us spending time in the place of formulation. Is, we've got our basic CBTE formulation, but sometimes that doesn't capture all of the things that you're just talking about, Amy. And then we're adding in potential health conditions and how do they all interact and interplay. I'm wondering about, who should be doing that formulation with Arthur? And then how do we make sure that that story reaches everyone else?
I mean, I think in kind of a typical setting, you'd be having a psychologist supporting that formulation. But, I also really like the idea of having space for Arthur to actually, work on his own formulation. So whether that's sort of collaborative with the psychologist, or maybe that's, that he starts with the psychologist and he goes home and with, a partner or a loved one, he kind of continues to work on it, because, we need it to make sense for him, and we need it to make sense for the care team as well. Like, it's a connected thing. If he's got kind of no idea what the psychologist is referring to, then what good is any sort of treatment or therapy or support going to be, because it's totally misaligned with where he is. And I think, it comes back to this really important point of communication. I know that when I've got clients where we've got sort of a big care team, my typical practice would be to, every time I see them, is I just send a little quick update email, and that just sits there. It might sit in their email and they don't necessarily have a chance to read it, but I know that they can easily refer back to the latest information about, how we're supporting someone through, the current circumstances.
Yeah, thanks, Ames. That's really, really helpful. Tom, yeah, I was about to go to you, Tom. You read my mind.
I just wanted to add on to that. I think dietitians are probably not the first port of call that people would think when we think formulations, but we absolutely do our own kind of like nutrition formulation type process, whether it's as formal as a mental health clinician might not. And I think it can be nice to kind of join the two together. Philippa mentioned before, this could be somebody who's got some metabolic health stuff going on. And so digging into that, like the initial instinct might be to say, oh, it's because he's overweight. But we know that binge eating behaviors often happen on maybe higher reward foods. When those are happening regularly, there isn't the restriction. Like it could be that there's something to do with the type of food that this person's eating that's causing blood pressure to be a bit higher or cholesterol to be a little bit out of whack. And so getting the kind of bringing in the biology and the nutrition side of things as well, I think to go with what our psychs are doing on the mental health side of things can be quite helpful.
Yeah, beautiful. It just keeps on coming back to, and I know we're talking about eating disorders, and core principle of care is a multidisciplinary care team at an absolute minimum mental health medical monitoring, but often the dietitian is involved. And then depending on the person's experience, there might be other medical specialists, might be physiotherapy, peer support, etc. I'm coming back to that idea of health and mental health, and how we're making a formulation about how all of these things interact with each other. Karen, how do you approach that? And then again, sequencing? Like, how are we still supporting Arthur when we might have a myriad of things that we're trying to address at once?
Absolutely. And I was trying to think where I want to come in first on that question, Sarah, because there's my advocacy hat where, and I don't know how many people are listening to us, but I would love to advocate for people to support our system to allow longer consultations, higher patient rebates for longer consultations, because this is really such a beautiful part of general practice where we've got mind and body, we have our physical risks, we have our mental health risks all sitting together with Arthur, who, let's assume he's got a good going binge eating disorder, but he may have depression, anxiety. He may have, as Philippa mentioned, the clinical obesity symptoms that may need more urgent attention. I feel personally that that does sit largely within general practice if the system allows it and if the GP is able to and interested. So I would be advocating for our clients and consumers to find a GP who's able to help them in a really interested way and be involved, because that's when the magic happens, where we actually, we have the, thank you to Medicare, we have the ability to write plans, we have the ability to charge for case conferences, we have the ability to refer for further investigation. So we are, as one of my beautiful GP mentors said many years ago, the head of the octopus in some ways. And if you find yourself a good GP, and like with everybody, psychiatrists, psychologists, dietitians, there are good ones and there are ones that, might not be as capable in this scenario or as interested in this scenario. But if you have somebody who's interested, that's where we go, okay, let's put it all together. And Sarah, I've also been loving the complexity talks in the conferences. And we do this all day long. More and more people have complexity, and so with the support of our, really learned and really beautifully communicating colleagues, we can do that together, and we'll get it quicker. We put the picture together. Prioritize together. We just need the system to support us to do that a bit better.
Absolutely. I'm going to come back to that idea of like the session times and how does a GP manage the tentacles that is the octopus. A beautiful reflection I had when we were talking about complexity in presentations is when people from different professional groups had the opportunity to say, oh, this is how I would approach the case. And it was wonderful to see, even, we're all seeing the same person, but we have a social worker speaking, and then an occupational therapist speaking, a GP, and everyone brings their own skill set and expertise to a case, and how amazing that is, to be really thinking about the whole person, and then each of the person in the care team being able to address which parts suit, I guess. We talked about the system, Karen, and it's so wonderful that we've got Medicare items for eating disorders when people meet the eligibility criteria. But how do you as a GP then manage shorter session times when you are trying to juggle the tentacles of referrals to, a multidisciplinary care? So if imagine this is the care team, so there's five of us, but it might be more, it might be less.
I'm the wrong person to ask because I do long consultations. But we have the College of GPs president a couple of times ago used to talk about general practice as one long consultation. So we're picking up bits each time we see people. So we may not need the length of consultation for a new patient. We know a lot about our patients already. I've been looking after some patients for, nearly 25 years. It's not going to take me long to do a formulation or to put these things together. Otherwise, you just get people back. Everybody works their own way. And they're, GPs are as diverse as their patients. I always say you will find somebody who will take the time, or you will find somebody who will get you back and make a longer co appointment, or you'll find somebody who will say, here, go away and do these screeners and get this information and then come back. Or somebody might just make a quick referral because they know that one of their colleagues is down the road and they have the time to do it. So there's just so many ways of approaching it, and beauty of general practice.
So it's just problem solving with the time you have, and yeah, and the people that you have in available in the care team as well. Yeah, Tom.
I think a little bit of a divide and conquer approach can sometimes be helpful. Like in this scenario, Arthur's come to see me. I suspect binge eating disorder. It's not the role of a dietitian to diagnose that, but I can collect some really helpful information, provide a lovely detailed letter through to a GP to say, look, binge eating 4 times a week, objectively large amounts of food. There's no compensating behaviors. I asked Arthur to do the online EDEQ through Inside Out, and the score is above 3 for global EDEQ. What are your thoughts about eligibility for an eating disorder plan here? And then that takes a bit of the groundwork out from what Karen might need to do in a first session.
Nice. I really love that, Tom. And I know there's wonderful resources out there for GPs, but we know that not all GPs have a lot of knowledge about eating disorders. So we're trying to get the word out there about the GP hub. Just we can go in there's training, there's re accredited resources out there for GPs. But what you're helping to do is then upskill the MDT by providing letters saying, this is my assessment, and you can link them to maybe something that a GP could use in the case that they don't understand. Yeah. Philippa.
Well, I was just going to add that I also prime Arthur. I say, Arthur, there is this treatment, and there are these things called these plans, and this is the
Nice.
NEDC website. And when you go and see your GP, this is the site to take them to. And actually, if you print out and download a few things before and do the EDQ before, that all will help set the scene for when you see
Nice.
your GP who has. And really, GPs do work very hard and don't have a lot of time. So that also, I think. Empowering the patient, I think the person with the problem to understand what is it and what is it that the is going to be needed if they're going to be referred on under the plans. But I have to say, most people are often blown away by finding out that what they have has a name, is a disorder, is a mental health disorder, and furthermore, there is Medicare funded care for it. It's often just something people are blown away by.
Yeah, beautiful. And that speaks to the stigma in society about different types of eating disorders, that we just don't have general awareness of what these different diagnostic presentations are and that they're common. Yeah. Thanks, Philippa. Amy.
Yeah, I think, almost following on from what Philippa was saying is that often, obviously in this scenario, we've got this amazing GP in Karen, but that's not necessarily everybody's truth. And as Karen mentioned, we've got some GPs who are really keen to upskill in this area. They've got a keen interest, and then other GPs who it's not their strong suit. And so being mindful that whenever we're kind of sort of seeing someone for the first time, is that there may have been multiple attempts to seek support in the past. There may have been multiple experiences of, anti-fat bias, discrimination, some really harmful interactions that may have unfortunately happened. And so every time sort of someone steps into an episode of care, for lack of a better term, they're bringing so much vulnerability with them, and it almost can fall on the care team's shoulders to support a little bit of that healing from maybe past harms that have occurred as well. So just something to be really, really mindful of. Again, coming back to this idea of the body story and the food story, it's also the help-seeking story as well.
Yeah, thanks, Amy. It was a beautiful summary. And even like we're thinking where we've taken this case from, and I knew I would do this tonight. I'm a terrible timekeeper. I'm watching the time and ignoring it as I'm more interested in talking to you all. But if we think about, so if Arthur had come in to a GP, what we would hope there is that the GP is able to take time to really explore Arthur's whole experience, really understanding, where is this interest in weight loss? What is happening for his physical health, and an awareness of using the GP hub as an example, is stepping through, is there a possibility that there is an eating disorder there? And then being able to refer out to eating disorder informed practitioners, using the databases, finding a credentialed clinician to say, I know that they can get mental health treatment there. But having that full formulation is really important to think about the sequencing of treatment. There might be really pressing physical health needs, and we know that we've got a pressing mental health need there too. So how the team can then collaboratively work together to continue with treatment, and maybe there are things happening at the same time, but making sure one doesn't actually impact on the other and worsen the eating disorder symptoms and or worsen health symptoms. There were some nice tips in there too about, just sending an email saying, I've seen Arthur today, this is what's going on. Sending letters with links to resources, supporting Arthur to advocate for himself. Is there anything I've missed? Yeah, Philippa.
We haven't mentioned something, I think, which is trauma. And I
Yeah.
think trauma is such a common experience for people, both people in the high weight space, but also people in the eating disorder space. And that may not unfold for a while, but we've just got to remember that this is someone who may have had very significant trauma in their lifetime as well. So that kind of supporting the person, and I think, as Amy, as you said, perhaps, not rushing too fast, not saying we can, sort this all out in six sessions of CBT, etc., but saying that the mental health professional you're going to meet is someone who will get to know you, and it's really important that you have an empathy with them and that they have an empathy for you, so that there is engagement as well, because it doesn't always work out with the first psychologist, but it will work out with somebody. And and some issues that may unfold with time with someone in a therapeutic relationship that they can trust. And remembering that, behind the binge eating disorder is a lot more than just the eating, it's mental health state and often trauma as well.
Yeah, thanks,
Potentially
Philippa.
neurodivergence as well. Neurodivergence, ADHD, binge eating disorder link, quite strong.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One theme I'm picking up here too is in terms of the possibly thousands online tonight, I hope thousands, that's how many we had sign up. But there'll be people online that have more expertise in eating disorders, and there'll be people that this is fairly new. But we're talking about mental health. Often eating disorders have felt like this specialist area, this siloed thing that you either do eating disorders or you don't do eating disorders. But we're talking about mental health care, we're talking about trauma-informed care, person-centered care, thinking about how we're supporting a whole person. We're not just focusing on an eating disorder. We're doing formulation like we do with any type of CBT or how we're providing any type of care. So I just encourage those that are online that are less familiar with eating disorders is to just say you can do this work, using your general clinical skills and then learning, about treatment for eating disorders, that there's some, really clear trainings and models that we can learn from so that you can provide care for people. Yeah. I'm going to close this case, Arthur's case now, and I'm going to introduce the next case. So we're going to try and get through three and we'll see how we go. The next case is going to present different challenges for the care team. So I'm going to introduce Krish, and Krish is a 9-year-old. So we're shifting age groups. Krish has been brought in to see the GP by his parents, and the GP identifies that Krish has ARFID, so avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. Karen, I'm going to start with you. Where do you start in considering care pathways and referral pathways for someone with ARFID?
Thanks, Sarah. I think first thing to acknowledge is that ARFID is a reasonably new diagnosis and many GPs won't know a lot about it. So, in terms of care pathways, I think it is pretty similar to other eating disorders in that we must have a multidisciplinary team and we must look for specialised support. And particularly for ARFID, it's really important to have people on the team who know exactly how to treat it. But just to put in a little bit of a plug for GPs who may not have heard of ARFID, that there are some good places to go for information. Recently, we've done a masterclass on ARFID at the Australian Society of Psychological Medicine. We did a that'll be available on the website there, which included an hour session on ARFID, and also there's some information in the GP hub as well. So I don't want to go into that first, but just to really
Yeah,
acknowledge
great,
out
Karen.
there that if they haven't heard of ARFID and they don't want know what to do, don't panic, slow down. There are resources, and of course NEDC and Butterfly and all of the other terrific resources in the area will have pathways into finding out about it, because there are some very specific jobs for the GP first, even before care pathways. We're needing to look at comorbidities, we're needing to look at assessing nutritional deficiencies, and to institute management within that sort of early stage, whilst we're looking for expert support, whether it's a paediatrician or a dietitian or a psychologist. They need to understand how to manage it. So I think that's probably my first step is educate yourself, find out who's out there, and create that team as well. Sadly, it doesn't qualify for the eating disorder management plan, but there are ways to access some support, as you're aware, through mental health care plans and through chronic care management plans, which can include some sessions for the dietitian. So being able to use online resources, I think, is important too, because it can be intensive treatment.
So we're thinking at the moment then, whilst the ideal is that we have an equipped public mental health system and a private mental health system that can respond to eating disorders, but ARFID is fairly new. And, when we're saying new, but everything takes time. Research takes time to catch up so we know how we're treating it with, evidence-based care. So ARFID is not, people with ARFID are not eligible to access the eating disorder management plan under Medicare, but they can access the mental health care plan and chronic disease management plan. What happens if you don't have anyone that you can refer to, particularly in your region? We're still upskilling a workforce to be able to respond to ARFID. Mental health dietitians, speech pathologists, occupational therapists, depending on what that young person's experience is.
Is that still to me?
What would you do?
Well, I mean, GPs really are masters of finding information. We're not backwards in saying, I don't know. I don't know if I can speak for everybody, but I'm certainly not shy to say, I don't know. Here, let's Google it together. And, looking at the connected ANZ treatment database, Inside Out, looking for information there. There are other places to get information, and just sharing that humility that we don't know everything. I think, we're used to that. We're used to people coming in with, I've found this on Google, you get me this. So I don't think anybody expects us to know everything anymore. So I think
Yeah,
that,
you have to know a lot about a lot of things, Karen.
a lot about a little, about
Yeah.
a lot, whatever way around it is.
A little about a lot. So, Philippa, around the eating disorder management plan or a mental health care plan, there is a financial gap that the family are needing to pay. How would you approach it then if the family said, look, we just can't afford that gap payment? How else are we going to be able to support Krish?
Well, we have to think about public health care services, and indeed in sort of child mental health and child psychiatry, there are public mental health services, and they will recognise and know what ARFID is. So think about your local public hospital, your local child and youth mental health services as well. Don't forget to seek out them, because they may well be able to help, and indeed offer, a family-based approach and an all-round care approach. For someone with ARFID, it's absolutely, you're going to have that multidisciplinary team you need, because by definition there will be nutritional deficiencies, if not significant loss of weight and the impact of that. So you do need the paediatrician and the dietitian as well. And the approach to care is very similar to that for other young people that age with an eating disorder such as anorexia nervosa. It is a psychobehavioral approach with involving the family. So that's what I would do. I would say, look around. Don't forget the public services, because they may well be the first and good port of call for help. I don't know if Karen, if you'll found that as well, but it's just my impression that in this age group, the public services are probably as important as private.
Absolutely. And we would know how to access those in our general practice, but also, like, diagnosing the comorbidity opens more doors, doesn't it? So if we can recognize that there are often comorbidities in the different phenotypes of ARFID, if we can tease that out, then they may be more eligible for some of the public services.
And the things that Tom was talking about, very, 9-year-old boys with ARFID, ADHD, autism, etc. And there may be services that can be accessed and need to be accessed to help with those very common comorbidities.
Thank you. I was actually going to throw to you there, Tom, too, is thinking about some of those co-occurring conditions. So we're hearing, nutritional deficiencies are present. if someone has an ARFD, so they're probably going to be seeing a dietitian and thinking about whether there's supplements or, different dietary requirements. How do you then go about, this the care team for someone with ARFD might be quite large. You might have a speech pathologist if there is some kind of chewing or swallowing. You might have an OT for sensory aversions. How do you go about then talking about what you're doing? Is it the same that we were talking about with Arthur? We send emails. Is there something different?
I think care teams tend to find their rhythm, and it probably it's a little bit different each time. When there is complex needs going on, and when there's a lot of people involved, I love to be able to bring people together if we can at least once, just like for a bit of a case consultation, or as many people as possible, so that we can just make sure we're really on the same page to start with. And then I find that the follow-up that happens after that is a lot easier because we really have a shared kind of understanding of what are the priorities here and who's doing what, and then the communication that comes afterwards via things like letters or maybe an email thread is a little bit easier to handle rather than 20 emails just trying to work out, well, where are we starting?
Amy, do you have any reflections there in thinking about what might support an MDT in this instance? And we're thinking about we've got Krish, 9-year-old, parents going, what is this thing? What's ARFID? What should the care
Yeah,
team be thinking
absolutely.
about?
I mean, the really obvious one is that, we do need this really family-oriented approach. And actually, all eating disorders benefit from having, family support or friend support, chosen family, whoever that is, kind of bringing people together as much as possible. But Chris is little, he's 9. So his parents, his immediate family, who whatever that looks like, are going to be absolutely crucial to his engagement with support and treatment, but also, the next steps, what happens at home, it's really important. And absolutely, like you said, it can be so overwhelming. So thinking about places like Eating Disorders Family Australia, Feast website, Eating Disorders Victoria, Eating Disorders Queensland, Butterfly, all of these sort of really lived experience oriented organizations that can offer carer support, offer a little bit of guidance around, yes, everything that you're feeling is overwhelming, but it's absolutely normal and it's okay. To even doing things like carer coaching, Philippa mentioned FB, like family-based treatment sort of approaches before, being able to actually talk to somebody who has cared for a loved one through the same exact same treatment process as well. Otherwise it's a lot. You've got a beautiful MDT, everyone's trying to kind of hold it all together. But parents, extended family, whoever it is, really benefit from having their own support as well. And also, of course, making sure that we're focusing on Krish and kind of the challenges that he's identifying as well. Because mum or dad might come in and say, oh, we're really worried about X, Y, and Z, but Krish might go, actually, I just want to be able to eat the birthday cake at my friend's party, so making sure that we're adjusting, treatment goals, so to speak, so that it's really reflecting what Chris is hoping for, as well as what his family is needing too.
Thanks, Amy. I was actually my son has ARF, well, not ARFID anymore because he's actually recovering. We're not tube feeding anymore, but thinking about those milestones of, you just want your child to be able to go to school. What are our goals and what does recovery look like for a young person with ARFID? What impact is this, might be a phobia or it might be a sensory aversion actually having on, I keep on looking down, what's his name, Krish, on Krish's life. And so working with the family, and I heard there too around like the psychoeducation for the family, like what is ARFID? And Karen, coming back to you, like the three different subtypes of ARFID and the overlap of that, what's actually going on for Krish in terms of how his brain might be processing information, how his body might be having an aversive reaction to certain types of food, depending on his experiences. All of those things be really empowering for a family. So they go, oh, I know why we're doing this because of this, Tom, I was going to throw to you.
I just kind of wanted to add on. I think you've done a lovely job of actually explaining some of this. Like from the nutrition perspective, I think sometimes people can be really well-meaning or intentioned. Like I'm really worried about this kid because they don't eat any vegetables, and or you know they don't eat this, and they can be very competing priorities for young people with ARFID around. I really want them to have some broccoli, and it's like, well, actually, this young person's not eating enough that they're starting to fall off their growth curve, and broccoli is probably not going to be the food that gets them there. So making sure that everyone's on the same page about potentially that's a goal for down the track. If it's important to Christian, it's important to quality of life, but that might not be where we start.
It comes back to what you're saying, like getting everyone on the same page about what's happening. So if Chris is experiencing ARFID that has three subtypes, he has sensory aversion, he has a phobia of eating, and there's a disinterest in eating, but what's our starting point? Can we nourish Chris's body by getting in enough safe foods? Do we need supplements to make sure he's just getting enough of what he needs to keep growing? And then can we address sensory aversions or an anxiety? So that formulation with the family, sequencing of the treatment goals as a shared team, be really important.
And personalizing that, I think, for Krish, because nobody really has to eat broccoli to survive. And that, so working out how to get there and how to get there in a way that really supports him. And he may never like broccoli, so
And
maybe
that's completely fine as well.
that.
Sometimes we can get really, in the eating disorder world, we can get really focused on what someone's not eating or not having or not doing. But it's also about kind of flipping the script a little bit and looking from that strengths-based approach and going, okay, well, he's not having broccoli, but he's eating three more foods than he did 2 months ago or something like that as well. So seeing all those little kind of those the goals or the milestones, like you said, Philippa, being able to see that for what it is rather than from this kind of deficits approach as well. Especially, he's nine. He's little.
That got me thinking too, Amy, and leaning on from what you were saying, Philippa, around if there was a co-occurring experience, say if Chris was autistic, what does an adequate meal plan look like? We're trying to nourish Chris, but when we're not going to be striving for all foods, that's not going to be safe for Chris. But how would you approach that, Philippa, when thinking about, what we want Chris to be able to eat?
Well, I think it's really working with the dietitian and working out what Krish would like to eat, what he may be able to eat with some exposure or some encouragement or some support, and what maybe he's never going to be able to eat. So let's not, go there, but how we can get to a nourishing diet, really, respecting his preferences, respecting his difficulties he may have with certain colors, textures, etc. We had a really lovely piece at the conference just this last weekend, Australian New Zealand Academy of Eating Disorders Conference in Melbourne, which was also about how may adapt things for people with autism. And there was a lovely example of actually weighing. And when some people are weighed and you put the sort of hospital gown on, and someone who is autistic may be quite sensitive to the scratchiness of the gown. And this unit had addressed that by allowing the person to be weighed in a soft dressing gown that was their favorite dressing gown. But they'd weighed the dressing gown first and then weighed the person with the dressing gown. And that just solved the entire, problem, went away. So really trying to think around, I think, the square and think of, yes, we how can we adapt this? How can we be a bit more flexible? It's hard in sometimes in inpatient programs where you're stuck with the hospital food, and the dietitians, I think, struggle in hospitals as well because they struggle to talk to kitchens and get, food sent up that they're recommending. But in an outpatient setting, and when you're working with families, you can, let your mind just flow and think of what could we do and what other types of foods or how we can get to a nourishing diet. Because at the end of the day, we all need to have food that's nourishing and that we can sit with other people and eat food in a comfortable way. And that's all part of life and living. And that's what people with eating disorders don't have. And that's what we want to be.
I'm hearing that too, Philippa, and thinking about what's the eating disorder and what's this person, and how we're actually able to tease out is the eating disorder don't eat that. Versus, taking a full history of, who is Krish, what's his life been like, what have his eating behaviors been like over a long time, and now what's happening for him and what might be driving the restriction that's happening with Arford. Tom, I want to throw to you just lastly in thinking about neuroaffirming care from a dietetics perspective. So in the case for Krish, if he was autistic, how would you approach nutritional management for him if he had sensory aversions?
Absolutely. So if there was concerns about malnutrition, we start with, well, what's safe, what works, and also what's the feeding environment like? Because I think sometimes we focus a lot on what to eat, but not the kind of how to. Often for people who have sensory sensitivities, there can be like increases and decreases in terms of foods that they'll accept or tolerate. And if we can create an environment for food that is a little bit more relaxed, a little bit calmer, we might find that somebody's tolerance just increases a little bit, and we could get a little bit more in. So yeah, start with what works in terms of food. We can supplement if there's big micronutrient gaps, things like a zinc deficiency that might be impacting on taste and appetite that could be compounding the problem. And then taking a what's important or where to from here approach, like's been mentioned by a few people. What foods would you like to work on, if any? But always kind of grounding it in a, if we can get somebody to be a little bit better regulated at the mealtime, then perhaps acceptance of food might be a little bit higher. And I think responsive feeding therapy does a wonderful job of that as a bit of a framework.
Nice, nice. Tom, as you're talking in, Karen, you're similar, is that me thinking from a psychologist perspective, you're just saying things that I don't understand. And so I'm really thinking about the MDT team is just recognizing and respecting the expertise that the other people in the care team have. You're just saying things like, oh, Tom, I didn't think about zinc, like, because I don't know anything about zinc. That's not my job. So my scope of practice would be supporting Krish if there is an anxiety, or you could do food chaining or something like that. But it's not to know, how much zinc does Krish need. So making sure again that, I'm respecting what you're telling me, and I know enough about what I'm doing and able to share what I might be doing with Krish, and then being able to provide consistent messaging to the family. So I'm hearing what you're doing, Tom, hearing what you're doing, Karen and Philippa. I mean, your fam you might be providing some the family some support. And then this is what I'm doing to help them. Beautiful. Have I missed anything in thinking about Krish? We started with we're growing a workforce, so it might be a little bit more difficult to find referral pathways. There are Medicare items. We need to be thinking about our public mental health system. CAMHS teams are starting to upskill in Arford. It's not 100%, but there are definitely referral pathways. And we need to be thinking based on our understanding of Krish's experience, whether it's we do need dietetics, need mental health, speech pathology might be there, occupational therapy, paediatrics. So broad care team. Anything else that I've missed to make sure Krish can get what he needs?
I think if we look at DSM criteria, it's diagnosed Arford or it's diagnosed anorexia or an eating disorder. And I think in practice, we probably see a little bit more murkiness than that. I work more with adult populations than young people, but we certainly see restrictive eating disorders with a significant body image focus with a lot of sensory sensitivity or kind of fear component, and also see cases of what was probably Arford and then with significant malnutrition over time, this like increasing preoccupation with food and body and fear of weight gain. I guess maybe Philippa or Karen, who does diagnose, could speak to this a little bit more. But just being aware that just because it's a diagnosis of Arford, it doesn't mean that we might not be working with somebody who has some weight and shape concern as well.
Absolutely, and that's something that we addressed in the masterclass and the teaching that I've been doing with GPs is that is another area where I am learning a lot more about Arford from my dietitian colleagues is in people who are recovering from their eating disorder and who are then able to speak a little bit more comfortably about their sensory preferences in an affirming space. And I was thinking that our communication that we're modeling here is really the antidote to treatment trauma, isn't it? Because there's so much misunderstanding that can happen in the system if we don't talk. But once can we learn from each other, we really are we saving the system money, aren't we? Because we're getting people on the right track, I hope, earlier. Rather than going down, maybe well-meaning but incorrect pathways of treatment because people aren't open to being curious, and speaking together. So,
And recognizing that the experience can change over time.
absolutely.
Eating disorders are ever-changing beasts.
Endlessly interesting.
Thanks, Karen. I think that you shared the link for the psychological medicine. So I think that would be a really important resource for people who want to learn a bit more about ARFID. And I think Inside Out have got e-learning, intro e-learning, and there's a few different webinars and trainings out there. So I encourage people to learn about more so that we do have clearer care pathways, that there are more practitioners across that, really diverse and broad multidisciplinary care team that they're able to respond to people of all ages that might be experiencing ARFID. All right, I think we're going to have time. I'm going to introduce our last case. So I'm going to introduce Lani, and Lani is an 18-year-old female. Lani has been diagnosed with anorexia nervosa by her GP after her mother brought her in to see the GP worried. This is the first presentation of an eating disorder. Lani's parents are separated, and Lani has just started at university but is still living at home. When Lani and her mum came into the GP, when they weren't really aligned with what their concerns were. So Lani is not really willing to engage, doesn't really want to talk about it, but mum is really, really concerned. The key thing I'm pulling out there too is that Lani's 18. It's a tricky age, legally independent, still living at home. Amy, I'm going to start with you if that's all right. I just want you to kind of maybe flesh that out a little bit more. Is it like, what else do we need to be thinking about in terms of complexity in this presentation?
I think I've worked with a lot of Lanis. So there's something really familiar about it, but also kind of reflecting on my own lived experience that real challenge at a stage where there's so much transformation happening in life. She's just finished year 12. She can now drink and drive and go to clubs and gamble. And she's at university. So all of these huge, big life changes. She's finished VCE. Huge amount of stuff happening. And what can sometimes happen is that, the eating disorder becomes your thing. It's yours. You don't have to share it with anyone else. So you can be incredibly protective over the experience or kind of really push back at any idea that it's problematic. Even if, there's lots and lots of evidence or and your loved ones are kind of telling you, that something needs to shift, something needs to change. What I kind of often think is that this can be a really helpful point for some peer interaction. Talking to people that have had lived experience of an eating disorder, because I find that sometimes we can kind of do a little bit of translation. We can kind of say, okay, well, I think probably what mum is wanting is this, and then vice versa. You can even kind of have some peer support with mum and say, hey, look, often, when somebody's at this stage of their illness, they're kind of experiencing this, and that's why they're shutting down. So you can do a little bit of translation, a little bit of go between, but also just kind of it provides that non-judgmental space of that's free for Lani, for example, to be able to say all the weird and wonderful things that are in her head as well, because it's such a shameful experience having any type of eating disorder. Some definitely more than others, shame is a big part, but if she hasn't been able to get any of that out before, it's really hard to then sit in front of a GP who you've known since you were six, and actually say, I think I'm the most revolting human I've ever looked at. That's so intense with and mum sitting right there, so that can sometimes be a starting point to just get the words going.
Beautiful. Thanks, Amy. I mean, there was many things in there that you said were very, very powerful. We talked about in Krisha's case about peer support, but for families, to make sure our families are connected in with, counseling and information and those sort of things. But this is the first time we've really talked about how peer support can be helpful to the person experiencing an eating disorder. This is, I guess, this is something that's growing, and how we're promoting, like, this is something that's out there. Can you tell me a little bit more about what the role of the peer support worker would be in the MDT? And then I'm going to think about how are we bringing in peer support into our MDTs.
Yeah, absolutely. So lived experience support really sits in that kind of psychosocial support, I guess, section of an MDT. We're not looking at kind of providing that active treatment or anything like that, but it's about having somebody that is sitting alongside Lani or whoever the person is, that is able to advocate for, kind of what Lani needs or is wanting, because that can be really hard to make sure that your voice is being heard. But also just provides kind of, this companionship, in it all. I think there's a really beautiful role for peer workers in eating disorder treatment in doing things like meal challenges or, doing some guided self-help homework or whatever it is. So kind of taking some activities that are therapeutic out of the therapy space and out into the real world, like going to some shops that maybe, or going to social situations that have previously been too overwhelming. I know I've taken someone to the pancake parlor, she was really keen to have pancakes again, and so that was an outing that we did. So there's a little bit more flexibility in kind of this in real time support that can be provided.
Beautiful. Thanks, Amy. I'm wondering if maybe Karen is, because we're evolving and we are starting to bring peer support more into a care team, how you go about like thinking about roles and responsibilities and communication when we have peer support?
Oh, terrific. Look, I'm so fortunate. I work in a private multidisciplinary eating disorder practice, and we are so lucky that one of my colleagues has trained some support workers, and we actually do have some lived experience workers who work with us. And I can only say how valuable it is, exactly in the situation that you've described, Amy, to have somebody standing alongside our patients who can kind of coach and encourage them in a slightly different way. I think from an MDT point of view, it is something that we're still learning how to navigate, because, like you said, Amy, it's not necessarily a direct clinical role. And so how we share information is something that needs to be really carefully thought about and curated within the MDT. So we're still learning, I have to say. I can only say it's very, very valuable, and I feel very privileged to be able to offer it to some of my patients. And I feel like it's something that should be grown, but also, to recognize that many people won't have access to that. So I'm wondering, how do other people have access to that, whether it's through an online community or through Butterfly or other family support organizations. I think that something that should definitely be considered.
Was actually thinking that too, Karen, as practitioners, regardless of who it is that's talking to Lani, is letting her know about the options. In the I mean, many of the states have peer support face to face, or there are online programs that Butterfly provide as well. So us thinking about who is in the care team and us starting to expand and evolve in what our understanding of who can really support Lani. Karen, I'm going to stay with you here for a second. In this instance for Lani, Lani's coming with her mum, and there seems to be maybe some hostility or misalignment between. And we are back. That was just a quick break, all planned, of course. Karen, I'm going to throw back to you though. But we were just talking about like this is what you're doing. You're supporting the family. You're holding Lani in confidence and giving her the space. Through that. Tom, anything different? Like how would you approach this if Lani's been referred to you and mum wants to come to the sessions?
Yes, I think how wonderful for Lani to have such an active, involved, like caring person. Not all of my clients are, I guess, as fortunate as that. And so, what I'd typically be wanting to do is how can we channel mum's concern and her passion about this into a way that's productive for everybody? Like, if we have sessions together and nobody else knows what's happening, what do you think is going to happen when you get home? And like, mum's going to want to know, and she's going to pester you and ask questions because she's worried. And so, you know, what about if we just brought her in for a little bit and had a little bit of a chat with her at the end, and you can tell me what's, you know, what's okay to talk about with her and what's not. I also take the angle of a lot of 18-year-olds would consider themselves to be adults, and I very rarely meet an 18-year-old who is fully independent. And so, you know, you live at home. Who does the shopping? Who does the cooking? If we're going to have a little bit of a chat about food, well, we might need somebody else in here to get an idea of what's going on, and so let's bring them in. And just looking for ways to kind of to get support person involvement, I find that if we can get it happening from the start, often it's easy to continue. It's really hard to try and back end it from session 10 when somebody's used to just doing things quite independently.
Yeah, beautiful. So having that conversations early, still clarifying roles and helping Lani to see the role that mum can play, because mum's a part of the care team. You know, we
Absolutely.
talk about this treatment team, but like families and supports and communities, they're the ones that are going to be helping Lani to get through this.
Yeah, I mean,
Yeah.
if you think about, you know, Lani had received a cancer diagnosis or something, nobody would be like, oh, just drive yourself into chemo appointment and just do this and, you know, all of it. People would be kind of, you know, coming around for support and containment. And so really just trying to foster the same mentality as much as possible. Yes, independence, but with support.
Yeah,
I
thanks,
think,
Tom.
you know,
Yeah, go on.
just to kind of jump on that as well, something that can be really useful from again the lived experience space, or even kind of just in individual counseling or individual therapy space, is also making sure that you know, we're clarifying with Lani that mum is a safe person to have in the room. You know, often we see a young person coming with their family and we assume, okay, we've got to have them there. Absolutely, you know, we all want kind of, you know, everyone to be in there together and to support as a unified team. But not every young person is turning up, you know, like Tom said, with a really supportive, safe network around them. So I guess again, you know, as Karen kind of said, you know, when you have that space just with Lani, it's just making sure that, you know, that number one, the consent is there for mum or whoever it is to be involved, but just checking in about the dynamics in that relationship. Because even if, you know, she's kind of semi on board, semi not on board, then the rest of the MDT can also tailor how they interact with mum to kind of work to get her a little bit on board, but also support, you know, Lani in the challenging dynamic that might be there.
Beautiful. Thanks, Ames. Philip, I'm going to throw to you just thinking about risk. So, Lani has low weight anorexia, and so there is a chance there might be medical risk, psychiatric risk, nutritional risk. So, in this instance, how are we going to support Lani and her family? Mum, dad, we haven't talked much about dad, but you know, Lani's got a good relationship with dad, but lives in a separate house. How would you approach managing risk in this instance?
No, it's a really good question, and I think it's one of the great challenges of working in this space is that risk arouses anxiety in the healthcare professionals. We're all worried about that as well. And managing our own anxiety and our own sort of concerns about that level of risk, and you know, what point should I be thinking this person really needs to be in a higher intensity care setting, needs to be in a day program or an inpatient program? What are the parameters around that? And of course, for every person, it's different. It's not an easy textbook thing where they have this, that, and the other, and therefore, you know, straight off into hospital, etc. And they also may be, we don't know much about Lani, but they often have significant comorbidities as well. There may be a history of self-harm as well. Lani may have been to the emergency department already, and you know, engaged tentatively with the mental health services in the public hospital via the emergency department or not. Don't know. We just don't have that sort of history. So it's there, and it's really managing that risk, being very, I think, being transparent with Lani and with her mother and with the family about that and about what the risks are and how we're going to try and manage those. And as much as possible, we know that's people's preference is to be supported in the least restrictive care environment and to be supported to have care and treatment in their home environment as much as possible. So we would probably have that as the first option if we can, if we can manage and there isn't a high level of medical, immediate medical or psychiatric risk at the time, we would support the person. And one thing I've learned through working in this field for a long time is to go slowly. Lani is not all there at the moment. She has come along because mum has brought her along. The GP is concerned, etc. So to go slowly, not to sort of launch and to say, Lani, this is what we're going to do right now, and this is what you're going to need to eat, and you've got to do that, and you've got to do that. Just take it slowly, just try and get to know Lani, where she's coming from, and you can, take a little bit of time. It doesn't have everything, it doesn't have to be done immediately as well, because that's because remembering that she's really scared, probably really scared about what recovery might mean, what the anorexia has meant to her, how it's maybe been helping her navigate some other things in her life. And when we start talking about, well, it's a disorder and we're going to take this away, immediately she's probably thinking, what does that leave me with? Because in some way, anorexia nervosa, as I was saying earlier, that binge eating disorder, they're mental health disorders. And there's often it's a way of being in control, of coping, of navigating through life in some way that will only become perhaps apparent if we really get to know Lani over some time.
Beautiful. What stood out to me there, and we're going to pull this to a close in a moment, but risk might pop up anywhere. They might be seeing the dietitian, a mental health professional, GP, psychiatrist, peer support. So it's actually understanding our own scope of practice, knowing what warning signs are, what's a warning sign of a physical risk, but I'm a mental health professional, and knowing how I'm going to then connect Lani in with the medical practitioner if it's physical risk that I'm identifying. So knowing what I need to know and then how I'm going to be connecting with the rest of the team, which is so crucial in all the cases with Krish and Arthur and Lani. The key things are taking our time, understanding what's going on for the person, doing that formulation, bringing the care team in so we've got that shared understanding with the person and their family.
Yeah, and I say it is a shared thing, and I really rely on GPs to really help manage and navigate those risks as well. And good communication, but picking up the phone, having a chat, because often everybody is anxious, and just having a chat, talking over the phone about the person is so helpful, I think, in terms of the multi-D team and supporting each other in the team.
Beautiful. Thanks, Philippa. Look, we are at the end of the webinar. I firstly want to say thank you to the wonderful panel. We've been through three different cases and we've gone in different loop-de-loops depending on what cropped up. There were really key themes in there about, eating disorders, we need multidisciplinary care. That's just core business in the way that we provide care. It can be across a number of different professional groups depending on what's going on for the person. And the importance of knowing what the scope is and the role of each of the professionals in the care team is, and having clear roles and responsibilities and way of communicating with each other to make sure that the person can receive holistic care, that we're all on the same page together and we're really listening to the person and what their experience is. If for those joining us tonight, MHPN would love to hear what you thought of tonight's webinar. So, via the button below the video, please let us know via the survey. If you'd like to claim CPD, you can access the learning outcomes in the supporting resources tab, and statements of attendance will be available in the portal. And a link to the recording and webinar resources will also be emailed to you within the week. But thank you for joining us on a, I was about to say Wednesday, but it's Tuesday. And please connect with other MHPN resources and the resources that the panel have been able to share. But thanks everyone, and have a lovely evening.